Well, I pleasure seeing you again. It's been
nice to be back.
Been a couple of years, I think.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So. I never do remember exactly the occasions on which I come up here. It's usually with a book or a movie or...
Well, they've all been books, but I can't remember. Let me see which books we dealt with specifically. We may have just done some interim...
Let's see, I've been here twice at least, I know, before. I think you were doing a series on poets or something like that at one time.
We may not have focused on an individual book.
Yes.
I think we covered you in general, I think. I'm not certain. But I know it has been a couple of years, and but it's obvious that you've been busy. In fact, the last time you were here, you were saying that you were working on this massive novel, but I had no idea how massive it was till I picked it up.
Yes.
And saw it was so big. I think the... Let's talk about the novel, first of all.
Are we on now?
Yeah. Okay. I think the most important thing, right off the bat, is how we pronounce it.
Al-Nilam. Al-Nilam. Mm-hmm. That's an Arabic word. You have to come down hard on the last syllable. It's the name of the middle star in the belt of the constellation Orion, the big winter constellation in the northern skies. It means string of pearls in Arabic, I guess, because the three stars of the belt of Orion are lined up with each other. But the Al-Ilam is the one right in the middle, the center of it.
Well, I know you've been working on this novel for a long time. I believe the publicity material said something like 38 years off and on. Is that right?
Well, yes. That's sort of misleading. I started it in 1950. At least I put down the first few notes. But that's kind of misleading to say that I worked on it for 37 years because I wrote 25 other books during the same years between then and now. And this one I felt I needed, and I very much wanted to let it alone in the unconscious part of the mind to see what would happen to it. And every now and then I would bring it back up and make some more notes, and the story kind of accumulated and worked itself out by accretion, one thing adding to another, and I just kept transcribing the notes on it, and until finally about 4 or 5 years ago I got them all together to see what I had, and I saw that I had the essential story and even some of the scenes. And all I had to do was transcribe the notes that I previously had and then write the story around those. It took a while, it took several years to do, of more or less steady work, but it came out like I wanted it to come out.
Well, in 1950, did you envision the book turning out the way it has?
No, you can't do that. No, you just work with the seed of an idea first, and then if it's gonna flower, it will do it in its own way, I think.
It's such a massive book. How many manuscript pages were involved?
I think it was around 1470. Or something like that in typescript. It was long.
You had to mail the manuscript in parts up to the publisher, huh?
I think I did mail it in two parts, as I remember the last format.
Now, when you wrote this book, of course, you made notes, and in the last few years, you were more or less steady at working at the novel. But did you work with an editor at all, or did you present this manuscript to the publisher and it has been published in pretty much the form you gave it to the publisher?
No, I didn't. I had 6 or 7 different editors on it. It was when the book was contracted for, I did it with Doubleday. Deliverance, my only other novel, was published by Houghton Mifflin. This one was with Doubleday all the way, but they had some personnel changes there so that I had different editors on it. Some of them wanted different things, but I always stuck with what I wanted, and that's the way it came out.
Well, I should hope so. How would you have several editors on a project? They would presumably cancel each other out in some respect.
Well, sometimes they do, but they, you know how it is in these big businesses, including publishing businesses, they have personnel shuffles and people leave for other jobs, or there's some sort of power fight. I really don't understand what happens at those higher echelons of publishing, but I've had 6 or 7 different people working on this, working on Al-Ilam, but they were all good people, and so the final one, Carolyn Blakemore, was probably the best of all, so it came out okay.
Now, unlike a lot of poetry, a novel requires some extensive research, and it's obvious that you have done it. I mean, you researched several things, such as diabetes. You researched things like, well, a lot of this you may have had in your mind, the information about the airplanes, very factual information about training and this sort of thing.
Well, yes, I went through that. Most of my generation was in the service during those years, and I had a lot to draw on from personal experience. But I'm not really a research-oriented writer. In fact, when I have a novel or part of a novel that depends on some sort of specialized knowledge, such as a flight or navigation or, so as in the case of Deliverance, white water canoeing or archery or bow hunting and so on, I like deliberately not to research it or read up on it, but to let the imagination have a full play on the subject, and it would be that part of the composition of those sections is completely research free, sort of like Coleridge writing The Ancient Mariner, which is one of the great poems of the sea, although Coleridge was not a sailor and knew very little about the actual details of sailing and so on. It's all a work of pure imagination. But I like to give the pure imagination a shot at the material first. Then if I need to clear up any details, I then go back and do whatever research seems necessary.
Well, you have a lot of information about aerodynamics, for example, which just didn't come off the top of your head.
No, that I did look up. Yeah. And I looked up the part about gasoline, the gasoline lecture. That's rather funny, too, didn't you think? Mm-hmm. That part of it. I looked up the part about the properties of high-octane fuel and that sort of thing. I couldn't have known that. But the sensation of flight and so on, all that's purely imaginative.
Now tell me about the device that you use in the novel where you have split the page.
Yes, I hadn't any precedent for that. I had never seen anything like that tried. But the central character of the novel is a blind man, and he's moreover a man who has just gone blind, and he's trying to restructure his world, or his in essence his whole orientation toward experience by means of his other senses of touch and hearing, say, and smell and taste and so on, and the other ones that he has left after the sight is gone. And it struck me as it would give an extra dimension to those parts of the novel in which I use that device to present his estimates of the people that he meets and the events that he finds himself part of. On the left-hand side of those pages, his picturing of the people from what he can tell about them under these circumstances. And then on the right-hand side, paralleling that and going down the page alongside it, is what's really there. So it seemed to me that this gave an extra dimension to those parts of the story, that a dimension that it otherwise could not possibly have. Sometimes the blind man, Cahill, is fairly accurate in what he assumes to be the case about the people he's in contact with and the situations he's in and the places he's in and so on. Sometimes he can get a fairly good reading on it from his sense, especially from his sense of hearing. But sometimes he's not anywhere near the actuality, and I try to play back and forth between those two things.
I thought I was going to have trouble with it at first, but you did allow gaps so you could catch up.
Yes, sure, and I didn't want to overwork the device. I wanted it to function in certain highly important passages.
What gives you the most satisfaction in your writing, your poetry or your prose?
Poetry. Poetry. That's the most it's the most frustrating and the most rewarding. And it's a higher calling than fiction, in my opinion. You can say more and you can say it more memorably in poetry. And the test, after all of it is one aspect or another of a verbal art. And you have, all you have to do to apply, to see for yourself is to think, to try to remember how many lines or how many individually worded passages you can remember from novels or from any sort of prose fiction compared to the number you can remember from poetry. I don't know how it would be for other people, but in my case, I can, for every passage from a novel or from any sort of prose fiction, I can remember 100 lines of poetry, at least. In fact, I can remember very few from fiction. Although I remember those, they're good, but the poetry has, commands so much more of the memorability factor of language than prose does.
It's so intense, too,
yes.
In a smaller way, whereas a novel is sprawling in many respects.
Well, you need time to develop the themes. Well, the novel does certain things better, despite some outstanding examples, like Homer's work, The Iliad, for example, which is essentially a novel in verse. In our time, themes which require working out, especially working out over a time period, seem to go better in fiction than they do in any sort of poetic form.
Well, there's also an advantage to fiction in terms of a writer's finances. Poetry, I would assume, pays very little, but a novel, for example, Deliverance was a very successful novel and successful film. And writers can live on prose, and it doesn't seem to me they can do that on poetry.
Well, that's true enough. I can't think offhand of very many poems that have ever been sold to the movies. Although there have been a couple of attempts to film the Iliad, since I mentioned that, and I believe the original of the film, The White Cliffs of Dover, was a poem. A very bad one. But usually they don't turn poems into movies.
Is that the one that was named to the song?
I guess
so. There'll be bluebirds over, the White Cliffs of Dover.
Yes, either that or the song was written for the movie. I don't think it's a matter of much importance.
Are you still teaching?
Yes. I'm just coming up on my 19th year at the University of South Carolina. Yes, I'll be there for at least a few more seasons.
And your focus is poetry?
Yes, I may write one or two more novels, but I don't have great ambitions to write more novels and make movies and the rest of it. It's not much. That's not where the heart really is.
But in your teaching, do you teach poetry or
I teach poetry writing? Alone.
Alone?
Yes.
How does one teach poetry?
Well, there's lots of things you can teach about it. I teach two kinds of classes. One of them is a workshop class, in which which is a writing class of people, working with people who write poetry or want to write it or try to write it. And the other is a reading course. And a contemporary poetry, British and American, one semester is British and the other semester is American. That's easy enough. All we do is read various poets and talk about them. And they write papers on them, and I read them and grade them.
I would assume that the students you have in your poetry class are seeking a higher calling, though they wouldn't be in that class.
But well, a lot of them, people get into poetry workshop classes for lots and lots of different reasons. Some of them turn to prose fiction. Pat Conroy was a student of mine at South Carolina, and he turned to fiction with notable results, and movies as well, and so on. I work on the theory that no matter what brings someone into a poetry workshop class, any kind of writing that they do thereafter is going to be improved by the discipline in poetry and the price that poetry exacts from the poet, and the increase in his word sense and his intuition for verbally dramatic situations and the rest of the things that poetry brings to the highest point. And in other words, if anyone has a background in poetry, if he takes it seriously enough, if he takes the writing of poetry seriously enough, then any other form of writing is comparatively easy.
Now, I believe you said you've been teaching for 19 years?
Oh, much longer. I've been in and out of the teaching profession since 1950. Before that, I was a graduate student, and before that, I was a student. So I've been in the academic world for all my life, most of it anyway.
Well, over this long period of time, have you noticed among your students any changes in their interest or in the themes that they use in their
writing? Yeah, sure. There are always some themes that come in that are conditioned by public events. Usually some of the students want to write poetry having to do with social issues, so on, but that comes and goes, so on. Usually the poets that come to poetry for that reason are not the ones that are going to stay with it. They're interested in the topicality and the kind of platform that poetry gives them to sound off about public events, or that they think poetry gives them. But as John Peel Bishop said 50 years ago, when the poet mounts a soapbox, the garbage remains in the streets.
Well, there's a problem about writing about topical events. It would seem to me that the poetry sometimes doesn't hold up too well. This may be wrong. I mean, Longfellow wrote about topical events of his day.
Well, it almost never does. It's not to say that there are not notable exceptions. Yeats is writing, for example, on the Irish uprising and the, as they call it over there, the Troubles in 1916 are very great poetry, and they were occasioned by such events. On the other hand, all the protest poetry about Vietnam and so on, who remembers that? It was dead before it hit the page.
Kind of like humor in a way, which is also topical.
A lot of humor is topical. Satirically minded nightclub and television performers like Mort Saul, I suppose he's still remembered, and so on. And the humor depends on the topicality of the subject to a large degree, and some of it is very funny momentarily.
Now, I have a feeling the material that holds up is material that develops universal human.
It's true. Yes, that's right. And if you can move from the tropical into something that encompasses more permanent concerns of the human beings, then you operate in the realm of real poetry instead of propaganda.
Well, in your workshop, you don't grade people, do you? You can't grade people.
No, well, you have to grade them. You have to say, at any university, you have to satisfy the computers. You have to grade them in some way. And every teacher who teaches creative writing has his own kind of system, but it's very personal to him. For example, if a student comes into the class who's already read a lot and has a commitment to writing poetry, is already fairly proficient in the forms and so on, and is talented also, he's going to be an A student. However, if someone comes into the class and is enthusiastic and works hard but doesn't have much ability, intrinsic ability, then you can't grade him quite as high. The ones that I like really are my personal, sort of my sneaking favorites, are the ones that haven't had much experience with poetry but kind of catch fire when they learn what it really is and what it really can do, and find in themselves kind of resources and abilities and in some cases talents that they never before realized that they possessed. Those are the ones that I'm really looking for, and those are the ones that you can help the most.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions about yourself. Now, you have a young daughter, and here is a long, beautifully illustrated poem, story that you...
Well, I hope you will read it, too, instead of just looking at the pictures.
Well, it's a lovely book, and... But your daughter's name is Bronwyn.
Bronwyn.
What an unusual name.
Well, yes, thanks. That was pretty. I like Welsh things. Brown one was invented, I guess you could say, in England. And my wife and I thought that we owed the British Isles something in the way of a name. So since Wales is my favorite part of things over there, we chose a Welsh name, Bronwyn, which means white-breasted, which she is. Mm-hmm. Sort of the white goddess type. You remember Robert Graves and all his concentration on the Welsh poetic tradition and on the mysteries and mystiques of the Welsh poetic character and the muse goddess and all that kind of thing. I like to think that Bronwyn, my little girl, got at least a little bit of that with her name.
Tell me about your life in South Carolina. I remember you had written a little story. I think it appeared in an essay. I think it appeared in Esquire some years ago about why you liked living where you did.
Yes, I did. Yes, well, you'd have to read that, I guess, and for me to set forth my reasons more or less fully, but it's been a good. I'm a Southerner, and I.
No.
And I,
really?
And I want to. You know, I feel that I should live there. And I've been transplanted and expatriated a number of times, and I've always come back to the South because I feel comfortable there with the folk ways and the people, most of them, and the music, and it's just what I'm used to. As they say, as Mr. Faulkner, as one of his characters say, you would have to be born there.
How do you orient your day and get so much writing done?
Oh, I don't know. That's not hard. That part isn't hard. And I'm a compulsive writer. My trouble is in staying away from it. I write too much. And although I like to think of myself as rigorously selective, I still write a lot, but I tire out quickly on any specific thing. I don't like to stay on one project and sit there hour after hour, day after day on the same thing. You tend to get in too close a focus on it that way. I do anyway. Also, the only thing I have against the writer's profession is the sedentary aspect of it. I don't like to sit all that much. So my personal solution to that problem is that I have the house kind of booby-trapped with typewriters. Anytime I get a little money that I can spend on myself, I buy another typewriter and put it in another room and start another project. So it could be a novel, or it could be a poem I'm working on, it could be a translation, it could be an essay in literary criticism or an essay on some other subject, such as the one on why I live in South Carolina. It could be a children's book, it could be a film script. And it could be whatever it is I'm interested in doing at the time. And in a strange way, the different projects kind of cross-pollinate one another. It's very odd, almost a mystical process, and that you see something in one typewriter that would be better off in another typewriter.
Typewriter. Somehow you seem to keep up to date. Somehow I saw you as a person who would have adopted computers.
Never.
Never?
Never. No, I'm used to working with typewriters. I've fooled around with them. I know other people that use them, but I don't want a system that takes one word out and puts another one in its place. I want to see both of them. Write it out on the typewriter and write one word down and write about 8 or 10 alternative words. I want to take the sheet out and have the thing physically in front of me and look at it.
Well, you can do that with a computer.
Maybe you can, but I know how to do it on a typewriter, and I would have to learn how to do it on a computer.
Your student, Pat Conroy, was telling me that his father would not let him take typing when he was in high school. He never learned to type, so he says that decision that his father made for him has cost him thousands and thousands of dollars and time, because he has to laboriously write everything in longhand on long yellow sheets.
I would welcome that. I like the way Dylan Thomas used to work on poetry. He would write it out in longhand, and he would write the whole poem out, and if he made such a... even so much as a comma change, he would copy the whole thing again, the whole thing. And as he said, that was his way of keeping the poem together. And I work on the principle something like that one. I go back and do the whole draft of a poem again, because there's something in every every bit of it that's, I mean, none of it is sacrosanct. You're always looking for something that could be a little bit better than what you have. And if you go laboriously through it, physically through it, by typing it up again, or writing it out in longhand again, you can see those things, and you can, with luck, change them for the better.
Well, you must have a lot of paper to...
Yeah, I drown in paper. The more paper I have on hand, the more I feel like I'm working in the true element in the true way.
By the way, how did you, on your manuscript, handle the split page?
Well, I just typed it up as best I could and then gave it to and then edited it by hand and then gave it to a typist who was better typist than I.
But she was able to type in the way you had set it out.
Yes, and if not, then we did the page over again.
Well, this is a very ambitious novel. I'm not quite finished with it. I didn't want to hurry it. It's like trying to hurry Mozart in a way. You know, you have to. A novel has
my
its own
goodness,
pace.
What an apt comparison.
Well, it wasn't mine actually. It was William Gass who said that. I borrowed that line from him. But you can't hurry a book. I don't. You can hurry some books, but literary books and poetry they set their own pace. And when you start to go faster, you miss things. And you
no, I don't. I don't write for people who do speed reading.
Thank goodness for that. Well, James Dickey, we've spent a half an hour talking. It was wonderful to see you again. I am confident this won't be our last meeting. That we'll get together again and talk about your work and your thoughts about poetry and literature in the future. And I thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Hang on one second.